Santiago monitored Pataki's State of the State address, and he files this report.
Today, I ask you to strengthen our efforts to protect New Yorkers by passing additional anti-terror measures developed in conjunction with Attorney General Spitzer. Our laws should show no leniency for those who possess chemical and biological weapons. And we certainly shouldn't have to wait for a criminal to unleash these weapons on the public before we put him in prison. Someone in possession of these weapons should face prison for life with no chance of parole, period.
New York Governor George Pataki, as he outlined a number of measures aimed at protecting New Yorkers from further terrorist attacks, including a plan to increase security at New York airports and expanding the state's so-called anti-terrorism laws. September 11 not only gave the governor the opportunity to talk tough against terrorism, it provided what he hoped would be convincing cover for a declining state economy that was already faltering when the two planes crashed into the World Trade Center towers. Recently released state figures show that tax revenues in New York have experienced the biggest decline since the Great Depression. The economy could emerge as Pataki's Achilles heel as the gubernatorial race heats up, and so it came as no surprise that Pataki would seek to pin the struggling economy on September 11.
The damage to our state's finances, like the act of evil that inflicted it, is beyond anything we could have expected. In Lower Manhattan alone, some 25 million square feet of commercial real estate was destroyed or damaged. More than 14,000 businesses have been harmed. 377,000 jobs have been disrupted or displaced. Economic activity was severely stalled, decimating tax revenues as the nation enters a recession. Our projected revenue losses will reach into the billions this fiscal year and next. We will lose more revenue than many states collect.
But even a catastrophe like the World Trade Center attack has a silver lining. The post-September 11 climate says the governor could mean profits for some New Yorkers.
I will also propose the Security Through Advanced Research and Technology, or START program, to help our colleges and universities secure federal and other high-tech research funding for the emerging national homeland security industry. We already have a head start in this area with the development of a portable system to detect potential biological weapons such as anthrax. And several of our academic powerhouses are seeking to create the uniform of the future for the military that will both protect soldiers from injury and shield them from detection. The innovations that will result from this work will mean new industries and new jobs right here in New York State.
On other issues, the governor promised that despite the state's economic woes, tax cuts, mostly for businesses, would go ahead as planned. He said he would again call for the abolition of parole for violent felons and urge the passage of tougher hate crime laws. On funding for schools, a critical issue in New York City, Governor Pataki expressed pride that school funding has risen every year since he took office and that he spent $1.4 billion this fiscal year on school construction. And he said his administration would work toward ensuring a fairer distribution of school funding.
Our local school boards, school leaders, and educators have asked us to give them flexibility in spending these resources so they can meet the specific needs of our children. We need to provide them the flexibility they seek and recommit ourselves to the education funding goals I set forth last year, to throw out the existing school aid formula and to achieve equity without pitting one school district against another. This year, we should answer that call.
But local activists who for years have complained that New York City is being shortchanged in school funding were scratching their heads today. Michael Rebell is executive director and counsel for the Campaign for Fiscal Equity. The campaign successfully sued the state on the funding issue and won a landmark case in which a judge declared that the state was in fact discriminating against New York City school children. And the judge ordered the funding system revised. But Governor Pataki has appealed that ruling, which means that in the next school budget, city children may once again be shortchanged.
And you're listening to a report by Jose Santiago on Governor Pataki's State of the State address. I'm Paul DiRienzo. You're listening to the news on WBAI Pacifica Radio in New York City. These brief news headlines from the city. New York City has reached a $400,000 settlement with the family of 7-year-old Gavin Cato in connection with his 1991 death. A friend of the Cato family and a city spokesman say the agreement was reached. The agreement was reached on December 27th, just days before former Mayor Rudolph Giuliani left office. Word of the settlement comes 2 days after a federal appeals court panel overturned the convictions of two African-American men in the killing of a rabbinical student in the days of rebellion that followed Cato's death. Recovery workers at Ground Zero have uncovered a commuter train lying underneath the rubble of the World Trade Center, but no bodies were found inside the train, fortunately. The train was one of several that carried thousands of passengers each day into Lower Manhattan from New Jersey. It was the only one not to leave the underground station owned by the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey as the September 11th terrorist attacks unfolded. Are you ready for a made-for-TV movie about the September 11th terrorist attacks? You'll have the chance to answer that question because CBS is in the process of developing a TV movie titled The Real Story of Flight 93. That is the plane that crashed in Pennsylvania after passengers banded together and thwarted hijackers' plans to crash the jet in the Washington, D.C. area. The movie is said to be told from the perspective of the people on the ground, and it's one of several projects built around the events aboard Flight 93 to be pitched to the networks. It remains to be seen whether the viewing audience is ready to embrace dramatic presentations based on the September 11th attacks. And finally, a Westchester woman claimed she was fired from the New York School for the Deaf because she got implants that allow her to hear. Dorothy Carroll of Ardsley was born deaf. She says she wore hearing aids to hear a little, but she lost much of her hearing in the last 5 or 6 years. So she decided to get a cochlear implant. The cochlear implant is a hearing implant to help her hear. She says that decision cost her a job at the New York School for the Deaf in Greenberg. I'm Paul DiRienzo. That's some of the news.
Paul, say, if you would, for a moment. While I was in London, there was a big story in all the papers. A woman who, for many years, has headed the very, very influential organization for full-sized women, I guess is the best way to put it. In other words, maintaining that people have a right to their own size and mm-hmm. that they shouldn't be criticized, particularly in the workplace,
right.
was kicked out of the organization because she went on a diet. she lost weight.
Well, they were waiting for her to sing. And she
She said her doctor told her that for health reasons, you need to lose a little weight. So she lost the weight, and the organization turned on her and not only took away her leadership, but kicked her out.
Now, are you saying that if you can reverse, that's like reverse prejudice?
Well, in a sense, yeah, I guess you could say that. But, I mean, there's such an irony here in people saying, particularly in this case, I mean, obviously the woman in England, and she made the point that she wasn't abandoning her sense that women have a right to be full-sized and not to be criticized about it. But she said that for very specific health reasons, she felt she had to lose some weight. This woman, I mean, obviously here...
This has been an issue for a while because particularly for folks who are deaf, and I have some experience with mm-hmm. a close friend of mine whose brother was deaf, a whole world in a language. The American Sign Language is the third or fourth most used language in the world.
That's what
it's
I
up
understand,
there with
yeah.
English and, mm-hmm. and Han Chinese
right.
and all these
right.
different languages. And so it's a culture in and of itself. And mm-hmm. folks, when they get these implants, I've seen interviews and read reports, gotten some discrimination within the deaf community.
Well, it would seem to me even if you get the implants, doesn't mean you forget how to sign, for example. I mean, you know, one of the things you can never lose, you can never forget a language. You know, once you learn a language, it's with you forever. There's no way
right.
to lose how to speak.
Right.
So if this woman knew how to sign and knew other areas that are specific to the world of the deaf, just because she had implants and doesn't send any of that away.
I used to do the alphabet. I'm trying to remember. I'm showing you A, B,
right,
D, D.
Right.
I used to know how to do it.
Well, you know, more and more, unfortunately, I think we see less and less of signing in public events. For example, you know, I think in the inauguration, for example, you did see someone signing through the ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
But it used to be that virtually all public events featured a signer. You know, you mm-hmm. have a picture
right.
within the picture on
right,
television
right.
seeing that. And, of course, you know, all of this goes as part of a piece. So, remember the great struggle to put access to public buildings so people who were in wheelchairs
right.
could
oh,
get
yes.
in? All
That's
of that
major issue.
Were struggles. And I suppose yeah. now the next thing we'll hear is that somebody who was confined to a wheelchair for some reason is able to walk. And
here's the irony. Those ramps can cost a lot of money,
yeah,
the portable
do.
Ones and the
they
construction
do.
Of them.
Yeah.
And, of course, who is it that usually fights the hardest not to have to build them? The more progressive organizations that don't have any money.
Listen, when you...
Isn't it irony? The world is so ironic.
Irony is another term.
Leftist institutions that hate labor unions.
I think irony is another term for the world.
Right.
You can interchange that. When you come back, the 55 hour, I think, we're in a real mess now in the Afghanistan region. The headline in the New York Times, Iran exerts sway in Afghan region, worrying the United States. Pushing Islamic agenda. Mm. Well, what other agenda would they push?
Their own agenda, that's what it is. That's like such a cover for... Iran has been... I read Hopkirk's book, The Great Game, and Iran has been a huge player since the early 19th century as far as the imperialism, because England
right.
had a tremendous amount of influence
right.
in Iran in the early 19th century. And... Afghanistan is very much the wild country in between the two great British areas, Iran, one of them, and India, the other. And in the middle was the wild mountain country of Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been the western half of Afghanistan has always sort of been coveted by Iran. And
right.
there's a lot of Persian influence, like
mm-hmm.
in Herat and different areas. And the eastern part has been coveted to a large extent by the British, who mm-hmm. saw it as a threat to them. And then you always have the Russians to the north. And poor Afghanistan is like stuck there in the middle, It's sort of like the hub of the wheel.
Well, listen, Paul, we thank you for this report.
Yeah.
We look for you at the 55 hour.
Sure thing.
All right. Marcellus from the CITI album some 10 years ago. And I was just telling our general manager, Robert Daughtry, they were cooking in, man. And everybody talks about the new Lincoln Center Orchestra, how kicking they are, but this is some music here. Welcome to you.
Thank you. Good morning, Clayton. Good morning to those of you out there listening to 99.5.
All right, we have all manner of things to discuss this morning, the weekend upon us as usual before you know it. Tomorrow everybody will be screaming, thank God it's Friday. But a number of things going into Friday and the weekend that bear very close scrutiny and I think full discussion.
Absolutely, absolutely. We find ourselves on the brink of what is supposed to be the upcoming Pacifica National Board meeting, but much has happened as we've moved into this immediate arena, and over the course of this week we've heard from many people who have been asking us about Democracy Now, for example, and I'd like to just speak on that a bit. We've got a new board now that came into existence officially on the 29th of December. And we throughout Pacifica, as I'm sure our listeners also are anticipating and looking for leadership from this board. But unfortunately, it has not been forthcoming. Last week, I had an interesting conversation with the board chair, Leslie Kagan. And throughout that entire conversation, she never mentioned to me until the very end of the conversation anything about the return of Democracy Now. Now, that's significant because I had said on the air that if Pacifica, and when I make a reference like Pacifica, I'm speaking of the Pacifica Foundation, which is the office of the executive director, the board, which is part of the foundation, and of course the national unit in this case, because the program Democracy Now, when it left our air, was a national program. She did not mention anything about Democracy Now! Until the very end of our conversation, in which she said to me, can you give me your email address? I would like to send you a memo. And she ended up faxing it to me. I got it the next morning when I came in. And the memo states that Democracy Now! Will be on the satellite at 9 o'clock on Monday. So I thought, okay, they've finally worked things out. Now, I hadn't heard anything, and normally we would be notified. That is the way the radio business works. We talk to each other. After all, this is the communication business. So I anticipated hearing from our executive director, our interim executive director, throughout the day. I even had a couple of calls placed to her office for other matters, was not able to speak with her directly, left a couple of messages, in fact. Did not hear from anyone on Saturday. Sunday came along, and I got a very brief message that they also, from the executive interim executive director, saying that they also wanted the program on at 9. Now, I was really puzzled at that point because it's one thing to get a memo discussing the intention of the board itself. But then, of course, that has to be implemented. If there is an orderly process. And in radio, the communication business is all about process. There are various processes that make this happen. It's an interesting way that this medium works, and it's the most interesting of the mediums because it still allows for those of us, we human beings, to use our imagination when we interact with the medium. Television takes much of that away on a number of levels, but if we were to go through all of the various processes that make the radio station work, whether we talked about the technical arena or the arena of procedure, I think our listeners would find it extremely interesting. And I won't go into that now, but I am anticipating getting some process information. There's the national programming angle. They set up certain things for us, and Office of the Executive Director plays a role in all of that as well. As I mentioned, it was Sunday by the time that I got this very brief kind of cryptic note about 9 o'clock. Well, we already had a program, as you well know, very firmly in place that we were excited about that included Senator Corzine and another guest who I will not mention since he was not able to call in and get to us between the 9 and the 10 hour. We don't want to embarrass anyone. So my intention was to record Democracy Now! At that point, and we would play it later in the day, and then I figured we would hear something, and we keep speaking with national programming, calling until we get this straight. But what I've come to find out since has been quite troubling. First of all, none of the processes that would normally put any program in place or any national program especially have been followed or followed through on or taken care of at any level. So national programming has not been informed what the status of the program is. Just a tersely worded memo which almost seemed a unilateral decision. I'm aware that the board did have some kind of a vote, although there several I's and me's sprinkled throughout the memo that came from our chairperson. Nothing from the executive director either.
May I ask a question here? You say you received a memo on a board decision, the board's pleasure or whatever. Did the members of the board sign that document? Was there any indication of how the vote came out? I mean,
no, and that's another interesting. I'm glad you asked that because I had not received even a summary, for example, from the chairperson or anyone else stating over the course of our meeting on this particular subject, we've decided thus, and yeah. We wish to inform you that it was decided by such and such a vote that this will happen. None of that at all. I heard it stated by Leslie Kagan, the board chair, that the managers were listening in on the meeting. Well, that's incorrect. I did not get the opportunity to listen in on the meeting. I would love to have done so, and if I had had one of the participant codes, I would have called and at least listened. Trying to listen on the net was very difficult, and I simply was not able to accomplish it.
The process, then, I think is what you're saying, is not fulfilled by this document being sent to you, and particularly being sent to you so very late. You know, I have to say something here that just occurs to me. We're talking about, in a sense, maybe in a symbolic sense, a nouveau civil war. We are the Union troops, and the dissidents are in fact the Confederacy, because they have chosen not only to indeed secede from the Union that existed, but also to use tactics that it seems to me in the protocols of war would not be accepted anywhere in the world.
Well, and that is a choice that's been made. There has been a settlement. Let me emphasize this. There's been a settlement. There has been a shift in power on the board to a faction that was previously called the dissidents. I don't know what they're called now. I don't have any names for them. But they are in control, the people who want to do certain things. So this is should be seen, once a settlement has been reached, and it has, as an opportunity to set forth a new, improved, and healing direction for the network. Let's remember that the context for all this has been a lot of fighting, a lot of infighting, a lot of struggle. You just used the word term, nouveau civil war. You know, this some context is useful, and then I'll just come back and finish what I was saying about democracy now, but some context is useful. Several years ago, this has all been about one thing: who will control the network? And by controlling the network, who will decide what's on the air, who's on the air, do they get to stay on forever? Those type of things, okay? Or do they get to stay on because they do good programs and they continue to relate to the listeners and to the mission of the organization? That should be the standard, but there are those who want the standard to be, we get to stay on the air as long as we want, we get to do anything we want, and you can't say anything to us about improvement because we don't need to be we don't need to improve. Leave us alone. Let us have the air. It belongs to us, not the public. They'll use words like public trust and the public owns the airwaves, but the fact is the people we're talking about do not believe that. This has been a struggle for the air. It started out on the pretext of the firing of the manager in the Berkeley station. It quickly shifted to governance as the next hot blood issue, hot button issue. From there it was about the national board. From there it was about corporate interests, supposed corporate interest on the national board. They wanted to corporatize. We kept hearing that. Eventually the struggle shifted to here in terms of the locus and the focus of the struggle shifted to here with the events of last year. And since that time, certain words have been seized upon and utilized constantly as a mantra, banned and fired, and eventually arriving at the point where Democracy Now! Itself became the focus, because Democracy Now! Had decided to become the champion of the so-called banned and fired. Now, that brings us back to the present of Democracy Now! On our air. We take the program on Monday. I listen to the program. And what I heard absolutely appalled me. Absolutely appalled me. Here was this glorious opportunity to come on, to reach out to everyone, and to say that there is a new beginning. Because I want to make something very clear. The board has also decided that they will go on the air of the various Pacifica stations and discuss the Pacifica settlement, the Pacifica circumstances in all the cities, and begin to have a public dialogue on that. So why Democracy Now! Would decide that they would come on the air and devote half the program to what essentially amounted to an attack on WBAI, in my opinion, is confounding to me. I never got a call.
Bob, I just wanted to interject to say, since I had a personal involvement here, up until 5 minutes to nine that morning, we were still in the process of deciding whether or not Democracy Now! Would be broadcast live. You and I were having this discussion, and you were saying, could you continue? You were asking me if I could continue in the 9 o'clock hour.
Let's make sure that's very clear. We hadn't heard from our guest who was supposed to be on in between the 9 and the 10 hour, and we were wondering if something had happened to him. And
good deal. But the point I think that needs to be made is that your view was that if, in fact, it was appropriate to do so, that you intended, if not at the 9 and 10 o'clock hour, you did fully intend to broadcast Democracy Now!
Yes.
And in the same way you were, I was absolutely appalled at what I heard. Here was an opportunity for, again, the people who have been talking about it, to promote some measure of healing. What we heard was vengeful, spiteful, embittered human beings just splattering the airways with what can only be characterized, in my view, as the most venomous kind of rhetoric imaginable, and utilizing so-called guests to further that aim.
Well,
and it was fully the intention of that group of people that Monday morning to attack those of us who are here at the station now, to further divide people who, let us remember, were once colleagues. There was a time not terribly long ago when all the people we're talking about were the colleagues of people who are here now. And what I think has been forgotten in all of this is that the more divided we become, and we are becoming more divided, quite unfortunately, the more easily outside forces, I'm talking about forces completely outside the region of our enterprise, will have an opportunity to wage an attack against us and possibly completely disable this radio station.
Well, you know, WBAI and Democracy Now! Were never part of any of these lawsuits, but they've become centerpieces of the settlement. And this is because, in large part, what you've just talked about, that there are those who have been on actions of revenge, of coming in and just creating a bloodbath with the existing staff, which only hurts our listeners. Our listeners have supported this station, have really stood up and said, we like the programming you do. We want those directions to continue. That is what we're here for, to serve the listeners, to have discussions about the difficult political and social issues of the day, to put them in context and to utilize those as ways of promoting understanding among each other, as well as to help people to understand what is happening in the world vis-a-vis the actions of our government in places like Afghanistan, and we need to begin to think about places like Somalia as well. This is what we're here for, and this is what we would like to be focusing on. But instead, we have the manufactured issue of Democracy Now!, for example. Yes, I had fully intended to put the program on the air that day, but I did not hear Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. What I heard was a program bent on making a point, a program that was not balanced regarding the issue that it purported to talk about. I never got a phone call, and we'll talk about that in a second.
You tuned to WBAI 99.5 FM. This is Pacifica Radio from New York City. Clayton Riley here with you in the morning. We are speaking to the general manager of WBAI, Robert Daughtry.
And, you know, it's important, again, context is very, very important. I mentioned processes earlier. We don't necessarily have to know all the details that surround this, and there's some things that I wouldn't talk about because they're matters of, specifically matters of personnel. But this process is still in part in grievance. It pertains to union contracts, the law, Pacifica policy. The people at the program Democracy Now! Still have possibilities for redress. But what it appears is that in their zeal to simply ram this down our throats, they have just, they being the board and a particular faction on the board, they have just rushed this through without any of the processes at all, without any of the processes being invoked. As the person who is responsible for the physical space here and for the air, I cannot allow any more chaos to invade our air than presently exists. We already have enough people who are taking it upon themselves to reprogram the station, to challenge the mission of the station. We are working to bring that under control. So therefore, it is absolutely necessary that we understand in context what is going on here. We have a board that is taking questionable actions. Many of the actions, I believe, are illegal. They are not working with us in the spirit of compromise. We have an upcoming national meeting that's supposed to begin tomorrow. Tomorrow. Yeah. Here we are, mm-hmm. 24 hours from that meeting, and I, as the host manager in the host city where the host station is located, do not even know the location of that meeting. I do not know the location of that meeting. Does that tell you something's wrong with this picture?
Well, it tells you that there is a deliberate effort to create, in a sense, I think, a separate... Again, let's go back to my... I think it's a valid analogy. This is the Confederacy saying we will no longer be part of the Union, and in separating ourselves from everybody else, we will establish a kind of feudal duchy, I guess, and incorporate the work of serfs and vassals, if you will. It's a very unfortunate thing, Bob, and I want to go back to what I have observed, and I through this year of turmoil. I will say flat out, on the part of the people who have remained in the station, there has never, in my judgment, been an unwillingness to negotiate on a number of very fundamental issues. One of the issues that has to be clarified is whether indeed we are a collective. Because if we are, you cannot have built within a collective a cult of personality. When it comes down to people calling the station continually to talk about one program, we had a caller yesterday, and I kept pressing her to state to me what other concern she had. Well, clearly the only concern she had was for one program and one broadcaster. And it seems to me that the organization or the enterprise established by Lou Hill was not about the creation of special individuals. It was about the creation of a collective of people in the broadcast business who could bring alternative radio to the air on a regular basis. Well, when you abandon that essential principle and say, for example, let us talk about Democracy Now!, there was an assumption on the part of many people, I think, that Democracy Now! Was very clearly tied to those people who fall into the category of the banned and the fired. In fact, we were told on many occasions that Democracy Now! Would never return to the air until the banned and the fired came back. Well, clearly, somewhere along the road, democracy now said, well, the hell with the banned and the fired. We get, it's like that British film, I'm All Right, Jack. Labor strike being broken down when guys said, hey, I got mine later for everybody else. Well, that's what we're facing, and those are the things, it seems to me, that need very clearly negotiation. The dissidents have never, and let me emphasize, have never been willing to sit down in the spirit of good faith negotiations and discuss the issues that, in fact, might have led to reasonable settlements. This is not, I want to emphasize, in my view, a reasonable settlement.
You're absolutely right. When I had a conversation with the chairman of the board this past Monday, Leslie Kagan, the newly selected chairman of the board, Interim Pacifica National Board is the full name of this group. They're supposed to be around 12 to 15 months, and what they are supposed to do is to look at the policies and the bylaws of the organization and begin a process that addresses those, an orderly process. And this is what the settlement says. In my conversation with Ms. Kagan on Monday, I said to her, is it your position that the banned and the fired should be returned without any consideration of what happens to the people who are here now? And she said, yes, that would be honest. I think that would be fair.
So in other words, you bring one band of fired in and create a new band of and fired. Because there,
exactly.
are a group of people here who have been working, who have been doing the heavy lifting, who have been in the trenches. So Leslie Kagan's position is, well, the hell with them. Just toss them out. And this was their argument a year ago, that people, on what basis are we creating a new band and fired? Has, for example, someone like Earl Caldwell committed some act that makes it reasonable for him to be fired?
No, in fact, I pointed out to her that the people who were in place now were here fulfilling a need. They were asked to come in and take different program slots. They were doing so on the basis of one thing, to help the organization, to do what it is that we do, and that is to do programs for our listeners, programs that work to the mission of WBAI, that work toward the mission of Pacifica. That's what they're here for. Now, the other people who may have been involved with the so-called fired and the so-called banned, that's a different matter in terms of who made the decisions. But the people who are in place, you're exactly right. You would be creating a new group of band and fired. This whole matter is rife with various contradictions, because if you take that position, you're no better than the people that you have been decrying for the whole time. And I'm finding this board is following similar tracks as the board that they were calling a corporatist board, a board that was trying to mainstream the organization. They've been real good on using a lot of
rhetoric
and a lot of rhetoric. But the fact is, they are sending us memos that are basically imperious,
mm-hmm.
high-handed, dictatorial. It's the same thing, and totally ignoring any process.
Due process, I might add. Let me add to what you've said, that if, in fact, the banned and the fired are to be returned, does that mean there is no review of why they became banned and or fired? Leslie Kagan's obvious position is we don't care whether these people were fired for cause. For example, if they were not, I haven't seen anybody sue. I haven't seen a lawsuit brought forth on that basis. The fact is, and I will state this unequivocally because I was here, I don't know every instance and every case, but I will say this. Some of the people who were fired for entirely legitimate reasons by the general manager who in this instance, or in those instances, was empowered to do so. And they were fired because they did things within the shop, some of them bordering on the illegal. There are some banned and fired who could indeed have been arrested and charged for the things that they were doing. Leslie Kagan is now telling us, well, we don't care about any of that. They all have to be returned without any review of any of the cases, without any attention being paid to why they were banned and or fired.
Well, this is my whole concern with this new Interim Pacifica National Board, is exactly that kind of attitude, and that was what she conveyed to me. I want to be very clear about that. I had a conversation with her this week earlier, and that was exactly what was conveyed to me. I'm troubled by many things. Many of the actions that this board are taking are questionable at best and probably illegal. Many of the actions trouble me with regard to what they mean in terms of basic principles of journalism. Case in point, on Monday, when Democracy Now! Ran, they reached a point in the program where Amy Goodman said, well, let's see what they're playing on WBAI, because someone had told them that we weren't carrying it. So they patched into us, and we could hear your voice at the time. You were in the middle of something. They didn't stay very long. They then placed a call to the station. And I noted with interest that Amy took herself out of it at that point after she initiated it. They placed a call to the station. Our receptionist answered the phone. He was dealing with the call in his normal professional way. They were talking to him. Michael Moore, who was Amy's guest, identified himself. And shame on you, Michael Moore. And I'm not trying to be funny here. I mean that in the most...
Actions were disgraceful.
It was pathetic. He's talking to our receptionist and conducting his conversation. At no time did he say that they were live via satellite. The receptionist, in an effort to help him, transfers him to our public affairs director, Jabel Fai. Jabel is talking to Michael Moore. Michael Moore does not indicate that this is a broadcast. We're on live now. Thank you for agreeing to talk to us. These are the standard ways that people get releases when they do this on the air with someone live. They thank them for agreeing to talk to them, and they make it clear. They make it crystal clear that it is a broadcast. All right? They did not do any of this. He's talking to Jabel Fai. And I have to say here that Jabel Fai was conducting himself in a very, very direct and open manner. He was trying to address his question. I mean, here's a call out of the blue from someone, Michael Moore, who could be anyone, or it, maybe you recognize the voice and know that it's the Michael Moore who is some kind of a personality. I'm not sure where he fits. He
has
claimed the fame as Roger and Me.
Right.
I've not seen much since then that impresses me. At any rate, Jabel Fai was carrying on three conversations at one point with Michael Moore. Then Michael Moore mentions Leslie Kagan, who suddenly enters the picture and starts talking. And that really troubles me. Leslie Kagan is the chairman of the board of a media network, five-station radio network. And she's going to participate in this, you know, where they call someone and don't tell them they're on the air and they're having a conversation as if it's a normal and a regular conversation. She doesn't. It was interesting, too. Amy Goodman stayed out of it.
And it's also interesting that at the point Dick Gregory came into the conversation.
That was the third part of the conversation.
And there was going to be an exchange between Jabel and Dick Gregory. Jabel was cut off. Jabel was cut off the air because it was clear the conversation wasn't going in the direction they had thought it was going to go, or the direction they had chosen. They weren't hearing what they want to hear. Bob, I just have to add this because I found it so amusing. When they said, let's hear what's on WBAI now, the two words that you hear me saying are our Constitution and our Bill of Rights. Well, obviously, they didn't want to hear any more than that.
About the Constitution.
Yeah, right, because obviously the Constitution and the Bill of Rights is something that they have no regard or respect
for.
Well,
what kind of journalism is that? What kind
of
journalism?
It isn't journalism, and I will say this flat out. I've said it before, and I don't hesitate to say it now. Democracy Now! Is not a program of journalism. It is a program of propaganda. And unless people begin to understand that, none of the issues that are involved here, and that isn't to say that all propaganda is bad necessarily, but the fact is that this is not to be characterized as journalism, what is done on the program. It is clearly and unequivocally, in my judgment, to be characterized as propaganda.
Well, you're absolutely right, and I ask rhetorically to some degree, I ask our listeners who are listening now who are open-minded, doesn't it raise the question in your mind, Amy Goodman had to know and understand clearly that the placing of a call to anyone without informing them that they are on the air live is an FCC violation, well, and it is illegal.
Well,
it
Amy
is
Goodman,
illegal.
Amy Goodman certainly understands that, but let us remember, this is the same woman for a period of well over a year who was secretly recording the conversations of her colleagues in this radio station, including in this studio, where she wore a wire in an effort to create a sense that something had happened in here that did not, in fact, happen. She and Robert Knight consistently during this period were secretly taping the conversations of their colleagues, made efforts to secretly tape conversations in our staff meetings, and incidentally to tape conversations that were not directly a part of the agenda of the staff meetings. So when we talk about whether she knew this was a violation of FCC regulations or whether it was illegal, my response to that, Bob, is to say she knows and she doesn't care, because she has reached the point of believing that Leslie Kagan and others will protect her from any regulation or from any law that she feels she doesn't have to pay attention to.
I think you're absolutely right, and I think that what we're really talking about here is not Amy Goodman, not Democracy Now, but we're talking about service to the listeners. That is critically important, and the listeners need to understand that there's been a radical shift in the structure at Pacifica, that the board has been board has been taken over by a different group of people who have things in mind that are going to directly affect WBAI, that are going to directly affect the programming that you hear, and that none of this involves any orderly process. None of this involves service to the listeners.
We are moving toward 9 o'clock. This is WBAI in New York City. We're Pacifica Radio. And toward that end, let me remind you that we are a station that depends on listener support. We receive only a very small portion of our annual budget from sources outside the listeners. And for those of you who remember the old barbershop sign, I'm sure, Bob, you do. Remember the sign in the barbershop, three chairs, no waiting? Well, we want the listeners to know that there's no waiting at WBAI. Of course, we do have fund drives, but you don't have to wait for that. Utilize our website, www.wbai.org. That's all in lowercase. And you can make a contribution to the station right now, or you can become a member by taking out your subscription right now. There will be fund drives, obviously. That's part of the process here. But for those of you who are listening and are concerned about the continued life of this station, again, www.wbai.org is where we are. Robert?
Well, again, the board has inserted itself into program issues, and that's a clear-cut violation of our own policies and our own rules. The board over the years, and as recently as a couple of years ago, has reaffirmed on a number of occasions that the general managers are in charge of local airtime. And general managers, and I fall into this process, we try to set up airtime based on consensus. It's not something that's done on a whim. It's not something that's done unilaterally. Everyone who has spoken on this issue has not been suspended, despite what some would tell you. Only the most egregious of those violators have done so. We have had time and again on this air programmers who have elected to bring on some of these people who left here a year ago, who have not seen fit to file a lawsuit because any of their dealings with the organization were legal. But yet they come on the air time and again on our airwaves and confuse the issue with our listeners. Again, disservice to the listeners, which is unfortunate because it means now that I take up some time when we could be talking about Unocal and the oil consortium in the Middle East and what those machinations mean for American lives, for the economy of the world, and how all of that intersects and interconnects with us right here, whether we are in Queens, whether we're in White Plains or in Pennsylvania or anywhere else in this country. These are the important issues that we need to be talking about, but yet we have a group of people who are willing to destroy this station. This is reminiscent of those abortion warfares where you have people who say they believe in the sanctity of life, but they're willing to kill for mm-hmm. it. There's a major mm-hmm. contradiction here. In this case, we have people saying these are free speech issues. If you speak up, we'll shout you down because it's our free speech, and that's the only way it's going to go. We had this happen. We had mm-hmm. this happen at the last board meeting when people spoke up and just in their view gave clear indication that there was another view, that there had to be another side to this issue. In many instances, they were hooted, heckled, mm-hmm. shouted down in the so-called name of free speech. So these slogans, this sloganeering about censorship, about gag rule, that's all it is. There is no gag rule, but that's been an effective propaganda tool in order to conjure the image in people's minds of people in courtrooms and other places being muzzled, of Kafka esque type scenarios where you're not allowed to speak on issues that relate to the people. There is a dirty laundry rule, and like anything, that can be reviewed, but virtually every media organization in the world has that about its internal issues, which are not newsworthy and are not worth any public discussion because it only serves to perform a disservice to the listener. You can get virtually all the people in the world who want to see the dirty laundry rule at Pacifica. You can get all the people in the world into one room, and they wouldn't be 500 people.
Bob, there's an important note to make as an addendum to that. One of the reasons for not discussing some of the internal issues is because many of them might have resolved themselves into legal issues, at which point the very people who claim to be protecting the interests, let us say, of the banned and the fired, would have compromised the effort that they were making by having a great deal of discussion in public. You know, when a judge, for example, tells jurors, you are enjoined from discussing the particulars of the case you were hearing when you go home. One of the reasons, for example, for sequestering juries is to prevent them from discussing certain internal matters, particularly as a protection to those people involved in the dispute. And I think what many people didn't understand when they said, well, let's go on the air and talk about everybody's business, really, was that if somebody, for example, had decided that there was a reason for suing, having this discussion on the air would have been entirely inappropriate as a violation of their rights within the judicial system. You don't want people running around and compromising a case that you might have. Listen, Bob, we got a break now. As you know, as part of the attention we pay to process, we got to have a news report. Okay. So Paul DiRienzo is going to do that. You're going to stay, I assume?
Actually, I've got some time-sensitive work that I need to get out of the way, so I'm
okay, that's part of the process, I assume.
Yes, that is part of the process. However, I will return, if not today, perhaps tomorrow.
Very good. We look for you.
Great.
Thank you for being here. All right. We're going to... Let's take a... Oh, he's right on the money. Paul gets right here on time. Paul DiRienzo is here with the news. He's going to tell us what's happening in the city and the world.
Thank you, Clayton. Steep, rocky terrain is making it impossible for Marines to drive vehicles to the mountain crash site of a U.S. military tanker plane in Pakistan. Searchers are getting there on foot. A Marine spokesperson says they're trying to recover the bodies of seven Marines killed in the crash. Tom Ridge says the 2002 Winter Olympics will be one of the most secure sporting events in history. Speaking on NBC, the director of Homeland Security said every conceivable possible attack scenario has been taken into consideration. Morgan, we'll get to that story later. Fewer Americans filed new jobless claims during the first week of the new year. The Labor Department says new claims for unemployment benefits fell by 58,000 last week to 395,000. That's the lowest level in 3 weeks. A man who led the Southern Baptist Convention as its president for two terms has died. The Reverend W.A. Criswell was 92. He's one of the world's most prominent Southern Baptist clergymen. He was also pastor of the First Baptist Church of Dallas for nearly half a century. And to that jobless story, the number of Americans filing new claims for unemployment benefits, as we reported earlier, dropped by 58,000 last week. The decline was substantially larger than expected. Release of the report comes in the midst of a number of signs that the economy has been stabilizing. Many economists believe that the recession, which officially began last March, will end in the first half of this year. Even so, many look for the jobless rate to peak this summer. The four-week moving average of claims declined for the fifth straight week to its lowest level since mid-September. And Lisa Beamer, the widow of one of the hero passengers who vowed to fight back before their hijacked plane crashed into Pennsylvania on September 11th, has given birth to a healthy baby girl. Morgan K. Beamer was born Wednesday afternoon at a New Jersey hospital. Diane Morrow, a spokesperson for the Todd and Beamer Foundation, said today, Morgan was Todd Beamer's middle name. The baby weighed 7 pounds and was 21 inches tall. The couple also has two sons, Drew and David. Todd Beamer, who is 32, was one of several passengers aboard United Flight 93 who made phone calls to relatives or authorities alerting them that a hijacking was taking place and making plans to fight back. Beamer ended his conversation with a GTE operator by dropping his phone and saying, "Let's roll." A short time later, the plane crashed into a field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, killing all 44 on board. It was the only hijacked plane that day that didn't take lives on the ground. Authorities have said it was headed towards Washington, D.C. Flight 93 was scheduled to fly from Newark to San Francisco. The foundation's website asks that in lieu of many of baby gifts, those wanting to can make a donation to either the foundation or to a children's charity in the baby's honor. A Texas woman has been indicted on charges she falsely told the FBI her husband was a terrorist. 39-year-old Shala Hussein had claimed her husband had received an email three days before the September 11th attacks that included images of a skull, an airplane, and the World Trade Center. She also claimed he had a Hamas tattoo and entertained terrorists in their Houston apartment. Hamas is an Islamic militant group. The FBI say she made it all up. The FBI said she made it all up because she was angry that her husband would often go away without telling her where. He was cleared in court because he doesn't have a tattoo. If convicted, the wife could be fined $250,000 and sentenced to 5 years in prison. And these are nervous times for workers at the Ford assembly plant in Edison, New Jersey. The automaker plans to announce a restructuring plan tomorrow that may include shutting down the factory. New Jersey officials are scrambling to offer Ford tax breaks and low-interest loans to retool the plant to make a new, more popular vehicle. And beginning today, Rutgers Journal of Law and Religion is posting online documents that helped convict Nazi war criminals. The records were kept during the Nuremberg trials. They can be viewed at lawandreligion.com. Bruce Springsteen and countless other New Jersey Jersey Shore musicians cut their chops there. Stone Pony staffers and patrons today are launching a campaign to preserve the Asbury Park landmark. They want to prevent the nightclub from being relocated as part of the city's redevelopment effort. And here in New York City, recovery workers at Ground Zero have uncovered a commuter train lying underneath the rubble of the World Trade Center, but no bodies were found inside the train. The train had been out of service when the building collapsed. Buildings collapsed. It was the only one not to leave the underground station owned by the Port Authority of New York in New Jersey as the September 11th terrorist attacks unfolded. And New York City has reached a $400,000 settlement with the family of 7-year-old Gavin Cato in connection with his 1991 death. A friend of the Cato family and a city spokesperson says the agreement was reached December 27th, just days before Mayor Rudolph Giuliani left office. Word of the settlement comes 2 days after a federal appeals court panel overturned the convictions of two black men in the killing of a rabbinical student in the days of rebellion that followed Cato's death. A Westchester woman claims she was fired from the New York School for the Deaf because she got implants that allow her to hear. Dorothy Carroll of Ardsley was born deaf. She says she wore hearing aids to hear a little, but she lost much of her hearing in the late